Shalom, damn it. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, and I am thrilled to be on the Dave's Gone By radio program with a very special guest, a man who has given us wonderful music and tons of laughs when we go to the Broadway Theater. You've seen and heard his work on Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Full Monty, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, and also he has a band, he's released CDs, he's prolific, and he's very, very funny. Please welcome to the Davehood, Mr. David Yazbek. David, how are you?
I'm not bad.
Good, good. What's new? How has this autumn been for you so far?
Little chilly so far. Feel like a little cold sneaking in through my right ear.
See, you're lucky. Oh. My cold sneak in through my tuchus. I don't know how it happens, but usually I'm sitting down. It's nice and warm. But, I get up.
Thank God it's just your cold sneaking in through your tuchus.
Thank you, I'll give you a ba-dum-bum there. Ba-dum-bum. So, let me ask you, first of all, you may still possibly be best known for the delightful musical The Full Monty. As a matter of fact, the host of this radio program, Dave Lefkowitz, is at a university where they just did The Full Monty. I'm sure it's being done all over the country, all over the world. Let me ask, can you retire on that with royalties and however that works? Do you ever have to do anything again?
Put it this way, I could retire on it if I had a rent control department in an inexpensive city and didn't really want to do much
like
other
eat.
Than sit.
Oh, right, okay. But to live like a person, you have to keep doing and creating and doing more. But let's roll it back to the beginning of that show. How did you get the gig to do Full Monty?
I really didn't have much of a desire to be involved in musical theater at the time, but I was getting pretty sick of being involved in the music business, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was involved in musical theater, Adam Gettle, who wrote Light in the Piazza. At that point, he had written Floyd Collins, which is a great show.
Did Floyd Collins write back? Just kidding. Go on.
And he and I had been in a band together years before, and I was complaining, and he said, you know, I've always said you should write a musical, and I said, nah. Well, let's say I would want to write a musical. What should I do? And he said, you jump in over your head. You know, that was not advice that was not actionable advice, as they say. But about a month later, I got a call from him saying that he had gotten a call from the producer and director who wanted to do the Full Monty. He knew that it wasn't right for him stylistically, but he remembered our conversation and very generously sent them my way. And I told him, go buy my albums, you know. I think at the time I had two albums out. That'll give you an idea, and that's how it started.
Let me ask David Yazbek then, when you prefaced that story about getting the Full Monty, you said that you were sick and tired on some level of the music business. Why was it treating you badly? What was wrong?
Oh, on every level. I mean, the music business was one of the most corrupt and just disgusting businesses there's ever been. Now it's no longer the case because it kind of doesn't exist anymore. At the time, I had dealt with record labels, large record labels, who were just completely...
Well, what's a specific example? If you don't want to name the label, at least say what they did to you. Did you look at the balance sheet and they should have made like $500,000 and you got 44 cents?
No. It was more like promises not being kept. The lawyer who was suggested to me to help me with my first major label deal got me into a situation, and I was young and I didn't know what I was doing. But that's why you hire a lawyer. He got me into a situation and recommended signing a contract that was really, in a certain way, draconian. And then, after doing that and realizing that I may be stuck in this publishing deal for years and years and years, like 2 years later, he became the vice president of the same publishing company.
Surprise!
So that's the kind of business it is. I hated it, but the thing I was complaining about at the time was more about club owners and just being on the road and being constipated because because you're on the road and eating shitty food.
It's all right. You can say shitty. It's all right. Let's say it together. One, two, three. Shitty.
Eating fucking shitty food and just being sick of the whole grind. Not that I was doing it as much as some people, but even just doing it occasionally was annoying. And that was it. That was it for me with that part of the music business.
Now that you have your Broadway credentials, you're still doing music, but you do it your way. You don't have to deal with all the crap or the shit, as you say.
Yeah. I mean, it's doing it my way, but it's not really my way. I mean, if I'm writing a musical, I'm servicing the musical. I'm serving the characters. I'm serving the story, and that's great. When I write songs for myself, for my band, then I'm just expressing myself from the bottom up. Without really worrying about, I mean, one of the reasons why I've never made money as a recording artist is I don't know how to, nor am I interested in figuring out what people want. I just know what I want to make. So I make what I want to make and then put it out there. Fortunately, I've got this other kind of day job where I make what the characters want me to make or what my collaborators and I decide to do. It's not as satisfying, but it's pretty damn satisfying. And then if it does well, then there's something more than subsistence living.
And most importantly, if you're not constipated, you make what you want to make. This is important.
Oh my God, that is true wisdom. Thank you.
You're very welcome. We're talking with David Yazbek, who not only gave the world the full Monty, but also that very, very hilarious show, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. How did you feel working on that show? I thought it was hilarious and wonderful. Wasn't quite the Broadway hit that people expected. What do you think? What happened?
The truth is it did okay. I think it was banned for 2 years, which is pretty damn good. I think Monty ran for 3 years. You know, I believe that technically it was a hit, but certainly its second life after Broadway has been really, really good. I think Dirty Rotten Scoundrels celebrates its lowbrow stuff as well as its highbrow stuff. There's a real high level of craft and art going on, but then there's lots of fart jokes and, you know, stuff like that, and people love it. I mean, they love both sides of it. I think that when it came out, it got a little, for some reason, it wasn't, certain critics used the word crass, and that's not the right word to use with that show. That show is not crass. That show is, in fact, anything but crass in a lot of ways, but it's also definitely goes lowbrow. So I think that show is a little ahead of its time. Book of Mormon is, you know, a great show that's plenty crass.
Good point.
But, you know, I mean, when the South Park guys do a musical, that's what you expect. So maybe that's the marketing for the show. Anyway, Scoundrels did fine. It was up against Spamalot, which had just... It's Monty Python, so it had...
The brand name attached to it, I remember
speaking. It had this massive brand. But it's funny, if you look at how Spamalot did after Broadway, meaning on tour, and then more importantly, in all the different countries and in all the different regional theaters and in all the different, eventually, colleges and high schools, Scoundrels did a lot better. I think it's a better show, but of course, I wrote it.
Can I ask, do you, David Yazbek, do you go see other productions of your show? Do you go to the regionals? Do you go to community theaters? I'm sure you're invited every other day.
No. Almost never. I don't see much theater at all. I mean, I'm not a big fan of musical theater. I'll see something that sounds either extremely challenging, or if I have like 10 friends say I've got to see it, I'll go see it. But yeah, I'm not a big...
So you did not grow up on Rodgers and Hammerstein and Sondheim and...
No, I did. I grew up on all that stuff because my parents were fans, but I also grew up on Miles Davis and the Beatles and eventually Led Zeppelin and New York Philharmonic and...
Wild Man Fisher, Shuby Taylor, all these very important people, yes.
Shuby Taylor. Oh my God, there's a great Shuby Taylor reference. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I wouldn't mind.
One of the greats.
Is there any way you can cut just a 20 22nd piece of Shuby Taylor in, like, right now?
There is always a way to cut in 20. I will do that for you, David Yazbek. Ladies and gentlemen, please let us listen to the vocal stylings of William Shuby Taylor. We are back with David Yazbek here in the neighborhood. You're listening to Dave's Gone By. We're talking about music and theater, which actually a lot of musical theater David Yazbek really doesn't go to see, doesn't care about, because you're more into the popular.
Let me say something about Shuby Taylor.
Oh, please.
I had a little clip of Shuby Taylor as my as the ringtone on my phone for like 5 years. So I need you for that.
Oh my goodness, Shledovit. That's my favorite moment. Shledovit. Well,
raw.
You forgive the phlegm. But we are talking.
It works with the Yiddishy kind of.
It certainly,
accent, I think.
Certainly does. It. I always wanted.
Reminding me of my Uncle Bernie.
I'm sorry, what about your Uncle Bernie?
You're reminding me of my Uncle Bernie. Of course, he was emphysemic, but otherwise, he was a great guy.
I always just wish that Shuby had scattered over Jan Pierce. I think that would have been. Or Moishe Kusevitsky. That would have been a beautiful combination.
You are pulling the references out.
How Jewish are you, by the way?
Look, I met Jan Pierce, let me tell you.
What was he like?
He was bigger than life, sort of over the top. Nice guy, it seemed. He came to our high school.
Oh, very nice.
Talked to us a little and then sang a little bit.
But wait a minute, what high school did you go to that they're asking Jan Pierce?
I went to a school called Riverdale, which, you know, sounds like the Archie school, but it was in Riverdale, New York, and we had a teacher, I took an opera class, and she was very resourceful, and she had Jan Pierce come.
Wow, this is exciting, but I did ask the question, how Jewish are you? How Jewish were you raised, and how Jewish are you now, David Yazbek?
I'm not, religiously, I'm so not Jewish. I don't subscribe to any organized religion. I studied Zen Buddhism for many years. I still do a lot of that stuff, but I run away from an organized religion. In terms of ethnic background, I would be in the ovens if the Nazis were in power, because my mother, there's a matrilineal thing, and my mother's mother was Jewish, Russian Jew, came over here, married a Sicilian Catholic. As I recall, neither of them were religious at all. My mother, though, identified with being Jewish. The guys in the mitzvah tank would say that they have the right to be pulling me into the, you know, putting the tefillin on me. I know more about Judaism and Yiddishism and Yiddish music and Jewish music than a lot of people who are Jewish. So it's this weird amalgam of culturally, I would say culturally, I'm 70% sort of Jewish, but not the religion part.
I gotcha.
And, right? And religiously zero.
So are you fully circumcised? This is an important question.
Well, yeah, totally, yeah. Like, a little too much, I suspect. I think that the Moyle was a little bit too excited about his job.
Every Jew feels that way. Well, every male Jew has to. Every female Jew also, come to think of it.
And interestingly, some Japanese people, too.
Very, very amusing here with David Yazbek on the Dave's Gone By radio program. Speaking of Jewish people, I do want to give a shout out, Shalom, from our mutual friend. His name is Sean Altman. Not a very Jewish name there, but you know him rather well. You worked, what, on Carmen Sandiego with him or something?
Yeah, now they're the Jew for you. I mean, everything about it. Everything physically, you know, in terms of his bodily complaints, but he's one of my best friends. I've known him since we were 16, and we sang together. We had a kind of a Simon and Garfunkel-y kind of duo. I'm 5'8". He's about 6'3" or 6'4", so there was like a bit of a comic look on stage. We sang in high school. We sang in college. We went to the same college. Yeah, when it came time to write the Carmen Sandiego theme song, we had plenty of, we'd logged thousands of hours together. Still, still a really close friend.
That's one, he's a really, really sweet guy. He was kind enough to open for the opening night of my show when I did it off Broadway in August. Where he came, he did his set, everybody loved him. They hated me, but they loved him. So I guess there's real talent there somewhere, I'm telling you.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well with
him. Now, another person whom I would not expect necessarily that you would work with is one of the more, I don't know, I wouldn't say mysterious, but one of the more secluded, unknown characters in rock and roll, and that would be Andy Partridge of XTC. Because he's not out there doing interviews, he's not out there, you know, you see him and then you don't. He's gone. How do you know this guy?
He's not averse to doing interviews. If he has something to promote, he'll do interviews. He'll do it. He'll work real hard doing it. It's just that he hasn't appeared on stage since 1983 or something like that, or 82. He's a genius. He's like I don't know anybody else I could actually say that about.
Besides me, yes?
Besides you, Rabbi. But you're a genius of the spirit. It's a different thing.
Thank you.
He was one of my idols for several years, and then I met him because when I signed my first record deal, they said, "Who would you like to produce you?" And I didn't know any producers, but I did know that Partridge was a brilliant musician. So I said Partridge, and that's how we met.
Wow! And so, what was it like working with him?
He's brilliant. He's also a nut sometimes, and it was exciting and fun, and sometimes frustrating.
How was he nuts?
Oh, you know, he was mercurial. I wasn't used to people yelling at me, like, a couple of times just yelling.
Oh, you should come to my house. You'll get used to it real quick. Sorry.
It's a different kind of yelling. When an English person does it, you think something bad is, something's wrong. When a Jew's yelling, you know you're okay, even though they're yelling right in your face.
That's right! Damn it!
When the English guy yells at you, you think the headbutt's coming next. That's the difference. Yes, but it didn't matter, and we became very close friends for years and years. And you know, he just kept putting out just this incredible body of work that guy's done. And
is there a reason he's avoided the stage?
Yeah, he had a nervous breakdown. They toured so hard. XTC started out in like 1977 or something, 78. First album came out and they just started touring. And they literally were on tour for 5 years, like almost without rest. And they, during those 5 years, they put out four or five records. And they were just touring and brilliant, brilliant records. And they had a few hits. And they were really big in England. And I think their last tour in the States, they were touring with the Police. They weren't opening for the Police. It was a shared bill. That's how big they were.
And these were real policemen with guns and clubs. It was a very strange tour, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Sorry. Continue.
Nice one. And then, but I think Partridge, I think he was, you know, I mean, this isn't telling tales out of school. He was medicated. He had been medicated since he was a teenager. Like, his parents had put him on something. Well, not at Justice Grants, doctors, too. I think he decided to go off of it. And it was just this combination of fatigue, too much pressure, and then just this sort of feeling of like, what the hell am I doing? And he literally had a televised kind of breakdown where he just sort of lets his guitar drop to the stage and runs off stage in Germany. And that was it. That was it. No more stage appearance. God knows I've asked him to perform. He might have done a Letterman show. It wasn't him singing, though. It was one of Colin's songs, one of the other guy's songs. But that was it.
That sounds good. Now, if you had stayed in the music business the way you were, do you think that would have happened to you?
I think if I had stayed in the music business, if I had been what I thought I wanted to be at the time, I would look older than I look. I probably would have even less energy than I have. I'm thinking about friends of mine who did that stuff.
Oh, like who? Who are some of your? Let's do some name dropping. Who are your friends?
That I'm not going to do because I just said something negative about.
Oh, okay.
But let me put it this way: I knew guys And I was coming up at the same time as some guys who, you know, like Dave Matthews, I think has done, that's sort of like the ultimate, like, great, but, or Ben Folds, you know, like he was doing what I should have been doing, which is touring constantly and carrying his own piano and, you know.
That's very difficult.
Well, he had two other guys to help him, and it's still very difficult.
Oh, okay.
But when I look back at it, I think, oh, God, it's so good I didn't do that. I mean, I don't think I would have had a nervous breakdown, but I opened for Ben after he'd started getting bigger in D.C. He and both guys in his band were so wrung out and exhausted, and I thought, oh, that doesn't suit me at all. I can't function when I'm like that, you know? I'm not as strong as he was.
You took the right path for you, and it's worth it.
Let me say this, Rabbi. The other interesting thing about this is a lot of guys, a lot of people, great songwriters. I was just talking to Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne. I saw him a couple nights ago. Like, a lot of guys who really excellent rock, pop songwriters who toured and toured and toured, and all they want to do is write shows, write musicals, because it's your chance to write songs, to make some money, and not to have to tour it. Other people will do that for you.
It's a good point, and also that Broadway has gone through a sea change in the last 20 years of the kind of musical styles that are incorporated into what we consider Broadway music. So, mm-hmm. You know, people like Cyndi Lauper can say, oh, my music will now fit onto Broadway, where it never could back in the 1980s, let's say. It's kind of an interesting paradigm shift, if you'll excuse the expression. You won't excuse the expression. Now, let me ask, you have experienced, I hate to use this word.
Hey, Rabbi, can I ask you a question? I'm sorry.
Please do.
Any relation to Saul Rosenberg? You know Saul Rosenberg?
You know, most people are related by their last names rather than their first, but who is Saul Rosenberg? Please let me know.
He's a guy that Jerky Boys really, really admired.
Oh, my God, the Jerky Boys. Whatever happened to them?
I don't know, but Saul Rosenberg was the guy who drove the motorcycle into the crowd and called the lawyer. I don't know what happened to the Jerky Boys, but I was a big fan when they were.
I mean, also, that was one of the characters who would call up and do the pranks. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm remembering this now. My goodness, you're having flashbacks from 25 years ago already. Good Lord.
I have a very similar delivery to Saul Rosenberg. That's why I'm...
Oh. Well, actually, when I don't have a cold, my delivery is much closer to Jack Parr. Go figure. But you were avoiding the question, and I don't blame you. I was going to ask about the, and you'll forgive this four-letter word, the flop of Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Why do you think that just did not click with audiences?
Oh, the flop. Oh, I thought you said the flock.
No, if people had flocked to it, it wouldn't have been a flop.
Well, here's what happened to that show. I mean, I consider that show, just in terms of the financial definition, it was a flop. The truth is, it's in a lot of ways, it's my best work. I think the show, the day that it opened, the show was very, very good. But 2 weeks after it opened, because we kept working on it, it was really, really good. I think that there were like eight big problems, and I can't go into all of them because some of them are a little personal, but the biggest problem...
Is herpes one of them? Because, you know, I've dealt with that. No, I'm kidding.
The biggest problem is that we didn't go out of town to work on it. That was just the biggest single thing. If we had been out of town for a few weeks or a couple of months, you know, I think this show might still be running now.
What does Out of Town do? I mean, you have a script, you get it together, you start rehearsing. What are the things that you learn out of town with a musical?
Well, remember, when you're building up a musical, especially a musical like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, which is really complex in a way, even your final, what you consider to be your final draft of the script is really just the first draft. You don't start really doing the serious work until you're in rehearsal. And we had done some workshops, but that's different than putting it up on its feet. We have a director in that show that has a certain way of working and who had never done an original musical before. It's different doing an original musical than doing a revival. The revival already went through the process of many, many, many weeks and months of work. So
the revival is what it is. With a new work, you don't even know what it is until it's up there. That's kind of the difference.
A revival is what it is, and then you can interpret it, you know. But what we had there was, we were pretty sure we knew what we had, but we needed to see it, look at it, futz with it, you know, like cut some stuff here, add some stuff there, change this. When I was all out of town with Full Monty, I cut the most beautiful ballad I've ever written for a show. I cut it because I knew I had to cut it to help the show. I had plenty of time to cut it and then try it without it and then put it back in and see that I was right and then cut it again. You know, that's what time gives you. Or Jeffrey Lane, who is a master not just at writing but also a master at editing his own work, he didn't have the time to say, he begged to try stuff, like, let's cut this. And we just didn't have the time to do it. So that was the biggest problem, that we didn't go out of town. And I blame partially on my, Jeffrey and I are to blame, because we just said, let's try that. Let's try not going out of town.
Let me ask you, like, the day before or the night before the review, so you know, you had what you thought was a very good show. It wasn't all there yet. You had problems. But is it really not until you get through all the reviews of opening night and whatever that you really have no idea whether you've got a masterpiece, a classic, a hit, a flop, a disaster? You really don't know?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't read the reviews. I stopped reading them, you know, like a few years ago, because they just weren't helpful. Everybody knows what the reviews are, or at least what a couple of the reviews are. They know what they're going to be a day in advance now. So I can tell, even if I tell everyone, shut up, don't tell me anything, I can tell what it's going to be. You know, like, if we didn't get good reviews, I can tell. And it's interesting, because Dirty Rotten Scoundrels got mixed reviews. I knew the reviews before the opening night, most importantly the New York Times one. And I was so bummed about it, because I really was surprised. I thought, this show is so good in every way, nobody can not like it. Of course, critics have their own reasons for saying they don't like something or for not liking something. So when I found out about that, especially one review, I was upset, and it kind of ruined my opening night party. And the only thing the thing that kind of sealed ruining my opening night was that Ann Coulter was at the party.
Oh, God.
Kind of just felt like that just felt like an evil omen to me. And now, as soon as the reviews came out and the show didn't suffer very much in terms of ticket sales, I realized, oh, wait a sec, these reviews don't matter that much. And then Jeffrey and I sprang into action and basically created an ad campaign for the show, because the show is about being con artists. So we created this ad campaign where we took one word from each 12 or 15 reviews, and the show bought a full-page ad, or maybe it was a two-page ad, you know, because after you open and the reviews come out, you put a big ad in. So the next Sunday, there was an ad that said, "The greatest musical I've ever seen in my life, comma, really." But every word had a different critic. So what we were able to do there was just basically say, fuck you to the critics, but also, and we got plenty of good reviews, too.
You did, yes.
We have plenty of pull quotes to use, but we did that, and that's us saying, you know, fuck it, this is a funny, funny show, so come and see it. And it really worked. The show ran as long as it did. Now, with Women on the Verge, tell me if I'm getting too Broadway-ish here, because...
Get as Broadway-ish as you please.
You know, marketing a musical is really an interesting thing, and we have to fight Lincoln Center every step of the way in terms of marketing, because they're very quaint. They have a way of doing things. They like the same artists for everything, the same advertising people, and, you know...
The watercolor playbill cover, we know, yes.
The whole thing, and, you know, when you have Jeffrey Lane... You've got a guy who's won, like, I think he's won 8 Emmy Awards for comedy writing. And I've won an Emmy Award for comedy writing. I've had 2 hit shows. And, you know, he and I basically marketed Scoundrel. So we're there saying, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. And all we're getting is, no, we don't do that. No, we don't do that. And then when the reviews came out, there were some very glowing reviews about certain performers in the show. Patti LuPone, that's a big name.
Laura Benanti, right, yes.
Right, or Laura, or Stokes. Or, you know, there's a lot of people in that show who got great reviews, and it would have been very easy and very smart to put a full-page ad to point out those great performances. But Lincoln Center said, no, we don't do that. We can't feature any particular performer. It's like, wait, you're not going to feature Patti LuPone? I mean, no, we don't do that. So we heard we don't do that an awful lot. And as we heard that, we watched opportunities get lost. So my guess is that show could have run at least another, let's say, 4 to 6 months, which would have made a giant difference, because I think Benanti would have won the Tony Award because she was spectacular in the show. And remember, we kept working on it. The show got much, much better. So who knows what would have happened? I mean...
Well, how is the afterlife on the show? Are there now regional community productions?
So
there's a tour, but...
Here's what's going on with it. The cast album has been, like, enthusiastically received. Like... People in the business and outside of the business and fans have heard that the cast album of Women on the Verge, and you know the reviews were like, well, I didn't see the show, but how could it not have been a success? You know, blah blah blah. This is a great. These songs are great. These performances are great. So the cast album, in a way, polished some of what was tarnished about the title. Step two is we're getting a chance to sort of revisit it because we're doing it in London.
Oh, good.
Yes, we're doing it in April. And Jeffrey and I spent a couple of weeks in the summer, last summer, not this summer, rewriting the script and sort of nipping and tucking and making it clearer, the storylines. So we were doing that because the licensed version was going to go out, and we wanted it to be crystal clear what people who licensed the show should be looking at. You know, we even say in the script, we staged a version of this that was complex and beautiful to look at, and you don't have to do that. You can make this as simple as you want. So that's what we're going to do in London. We're going to try to do a production that doesn't get lost in the sauce.
Oh, I like that phrasing, yes.
Yeah, and so we'll see what happens. I mean, the guy who's producing it in London thought that the London audience would like it even the way just it existed in New York, which I get. I mean, London audiences are different, but we want to showcase our work. It's a wonderful script, and I'm very, very proud of the songs. Like I said, I think it's my best work. It's about focusing, featuring the quality of the work, and having a production that is doable anywhere. So the plan for this production is open in London, go on tour, not just in the UK, but go on tour to a couple of European cities.
Like Bucharest. I would definitely put Bucharest on there somewhere.
Oh, thank you. Bucharest. I'll tell the producer that's a good suggestion.
Now, we're talking with David Yazbek, who, of course, wrote, or co-wrote, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, the musical, The Full Monty, of course, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. But there were a couple of other musicals that you were working on, and I'm wondering where they're currently at. Were you doing a musical about Bruce Lee?
Yeah, I was working on a Bruce Lee musical. Boy, that was a hard slog. We did one workshop that only had one act and some five songs or something, sort of an international cast. And, you know, some people really loved it, and I just felt like it wasn't working. It just didn't feel like it was working. And I think my collaborators felt that way, too. And it just kept slogging along, and I'm not really sure where it's at right now. I consider it dormant for me. I told the producer, look, if you need to explore any possible avenue you can. He's so in the hole. I think he might even be looking at Chinese, like an all-Chinese creative team. So, you know, I wrote a few songs that I like. If he wants to use them, he will. If he doesn't, he won't. And I'm cool. You know, I worked off and on for a couple of years on that.
And getting back to Jews, what about the Houdini project?
Well, I was never on that project. That got announced with me on it. I had some meetings with the creative, with the initial creative team, not the one who there is now. And I think the producer kind of jumped the gun and said, "Oh, isn't it exciting?" But I never said yes to that project.
So you were there and you disappeared. Rather appropriate for the...
Nice. Very nice. And Houdini, you know, famous Jew.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So what are you working on in musical theater currently?
I'm writing with Henry Krieger. I'm only doing lyrics. This is the first time I've ever done this. Henry's doing the music. Henry wrote Dream Girls and Sideshow and a lot of other stuff. And Bobby Longbottom, the director, we're working on a show about Tammy Faye Baker that Kristen Chenoweth is going to star in.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. We've done some really good stuff. We are currently without a book writer. We need to find the exact right book writer for that.
Dave Lefkowitz is available. I'll throw his name in the ring.
Who is it? Say it again.
Dave Lefkowitz. I know him very well.
Oh.
Brilliant book writer. Very, very genius librettist. Just putting his name out there.
Okay, understood. Let me write that down.
Him and the late Saul Bellow would be perfect for you.
As a team?
Yes. He goes to Saul Bellow for inspiration.
I'm considering, I get offered stuff constantly. There's two things I'm considering. One is that is just a weird little thing based on a movie that came out 10 years ago that was a flop but then became a real cult favorite called Wet Hot American Summer.
Was that Janine Garofalo and people like that?
Yeah, and I'm friends with a lot of those guys, like with David Wayne, who directed it and wrote it, and I've known those guys for some time, and just because I love David Wayne so much, the idea of doing the music for it and the lyrics is tempting. The only reason I'm mentioning this, even though they haven't started doing it yet, is because they own all the rights, so I'm not afraid of anyone stealing the idea. If they get a different composer, that's fine. It's a really funny movie. It's really fun. What I haven't decided is whether I can do it schedule-wise. And there's another much, much bigger, famous title that I'm considering that I can't mention.
Saw 3. Is that correct? No, I'm kidding.
And then there's another title that I've been trying to get the rights to for about 10 years that I think I might be close to. So
ooh.
I'm also writing, I'm trying to write songs for my next album, and I instituted this monthly series of shows. Like, instead of touring, I'm able to play in one place in New York, the 92nd Street Y Tribeca, with my band.
And now your band used to be called Yazbek. Now is it called Evil Monkey Man, or is that something different?
The band is called David Yazbek and His Warmest Regards. That's the band, His Warmest Regards. Evil Monkey Man was my last album. That was the name of the last
album. Oh, the album. Okay, got it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm writing new songs, and I'm going to kind of debut them at these shows. First Monday of every month at the 92nd Street Y. It's called First Mondays because it's the first Monday of every month.
Oh, I get it. First Monday. Oh, I just got that. Okay, good. Yes.
And first one's November 5th. Special guest, the aforementioned Adam Gettle. Nobody's seen him sing on stage for years in the city, and he's really an amazing singer. David Wayne is my other guest. And then we have some really, really cool people in months to come. People that you would cream your pants over.
Oi, oi, oi. I would only cream my borscht over it. Let me put it that way. I'll add the sour cream in, and it makes the borscht perfect. But how can people find out about your schedule, when you are doing these first Mondays? How can they get your CDs for the band? How?
Well, I think their best bet is to go to my Facebook page, David Yazbek. They could also go to my website, davidyazbek.com.
And that's Y-A-Z-B-E-K. There's no C in there. I don't know what happened to the C, but it's Yazbek. Right.
Y-A-Z-B-E-K. Or, I gotta say, I'm a pretty good Twitter guy, so following me on Twitter, you won't be disappointed. If you're easily offended, don't follow me on Twitter, but I'm doing a lot of tweeting these days.
Oh, well, there you go. This is exciting news. David Yazbek is tweet. You can get, like, a lyric, a fresh lyric from David Yazbek. You don't even have to go with any of his songs. You just, he tweets it, and there it is. And you have to make up your own rhyme on the tail end.
And every now and then, I'll write a song on Twitter. I've done that a couple of times.
Really? How do you do that in 179 characters, or whatever they ask for?
Well, you don't do it in one tweet. I mean, you just do, like, a couplet. And you go, and then you do the next couplet. If there's a story involved, then people tend to want to, they hang on their, on the next tweet.
Let me ask you, since you also brought up your friend Adam Gettle, I guess we only really know him from two shows, but we identify him with a certain kind of music, and you with a certain kind of show music. Would it be out of your wheelhouse if someone came up to you and asked you to do a dark, frank, wild, horny sort of... there was a verb there. A wild, horny sort of show like Rebecca or a gothic musical, or do you sort of have to stay in that musical, comedy, light, pop vein?
No, I mean, I'll do anything that
pays.
I feel like, I've had some ideas for sort of, even for some over-the-top stuff. I was trying to, I was thinking, like, Nightmare on Elm Street as a musical. Like, you know, I definitely think I could do something like that, a big over-the-top thing, and I think I could do it very well. I think the thing that I have, that Adam Gettle has, that some other people have, but that my favorite songwriters have...
Is it also herpes again? No, I'm kidding. What?
Is anal warts. No.
Oh, yes.
Is a gift for melody and for the hook. So even if you're Adam and exploring places musically that go unexpected places, that maybe work in a longer form... There's something about his stuff that you just hook into. Whether I'm writing a floor-banging blues thing for my band, or a Noel Cowardy kind of thing for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, or something with a Spanish lilt to it, whatever it is, I think that I can't let it go unless it feels melodically special or hooky.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have Alban Berg doing Animal House. It would not work.
Well, actually, that's not a bad idea. That might be the one. That might be an example where it actually is perfect.
He tried. He only got past the first act.
I mean, Kurt Vile tried to be Berg and realized, wait a second. Melody is this weird. It's like melody is part of nature. Somehow it's even genetic, you know, and that's what I want to do. I want to write songs that are entities, and some people can do it and some people can't.
You know what? I like songs that are entomans. They're tasty, they're sweet, they're delicious, and then they go down in three or four bites. Those are my favorite kinds of... You don't even know what... You know what entomans are. You're from New York. Now, I have one more question, and it's been so wonderful talking to the delightful David. Yes, David, did we lose you? Are you still there?
I'm here, but let me ask you this. Does your question have something to do with my first Monday of every month, 92nd Street Y, Tribeca, in New York City gig that I'm doing every month?
Amazingly enough, no. But thank you for reminding us about that and also about your website, davidyazbek.com, or finding David Yazbek on Facebook, or also getting his Twitter. What is the Twitter tweet? What's your handle on that?
Oh, what is my handle? Let me see.
It's at symbol something, at 70% Jew, something along those lines.
I'm guessing it's at David Yazbek. Yazbek. I'm looking at it right now.
That would make perfect sense to have that. But no, my question had nothing to do with all those things that you were very careful to remind us about. No, I just have to ask what it was like. You mentioned before that you have won Emmy Awards for comedy writing. People might not know that you used to write for the David Letterman program. So,
yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
What on earth was that like? Did you have to procure him, you know, sexy interns, or what did you do?
I wrote jokes and sketches and bits First, it was kind of exciting, but really, if you needed to compare it to a gig, it's like probably similar to wearing a respirator and bringing crops with noxious gas all day in the heat. That's probably what I would compare it to.
Oh, boy. Seriously, was it because it was high pressure, or you would write 10 jokes and they would use maybe one? I mean, what was awful about it?
Yeah, I mean, you know that going in. You know that you're going in and you're gonna, and the attrition rate for your jokes is gonna be giant. You also know that your best jokes are gonna get cut almost definitely. Usually, that's a matter of opinion. But mostly for me, it was going to an office, and then, even though it was 30 Rock, you know, a really great building, and then going into this little office, and then there's the typewriter. At the time, they were Selectrics. This was pre...
Wow.
And then, you know, there's some nice people, but there's a lot of, you know, comedy writers are not the greatest people in the world to hang with.
Somehow I know this, yes.
Some of them are. And then you've got Letterman, and he was, at the time, he probably still is, he's just kind of not a great boss, like, weirdly paranoid, it seemed, and not engaged with other people, and it just, the whole thing was just depressing to me, kind of, and it's very hard to be funny when you're depressed. But what I am finding is with Twitter, because I just started doing it like 4 months ago, and it was like, I'm going to do it because they told me to do it. They said it would help promote stuff. But then what I find is, whatever that proclivity for gags was that I had that made me get hired as a writer, I still got it. It's just this weird thing. But with Twitter, you're not making any money doing it, but you just do it when you want. So there's always something going on with, you know, wordplay or just jokes or gags.
Well, let me ask you two questions, and then to sort of compare and contrast, what was the favorite joke that you, or one-liner or whatever, or bit, that you ever wrote for Letterman, whether it got on the air or not? And then what is your favorite recent tweet?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Thank you.
I think, you know, I mean, my partner and I, you know, we contributed to the Fun with Velcro show, and that was great. I came up with Larry Bud Melman meeting people at the Port Authority bus station.
Wait a minute. You thought of that? That was you?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think of Larry Bud Melman, but I used him to greet people at Port Authority and hand them hot towels and give them advice about New York City.
That was the single most defining moment of the early Letterman period. That moment when Larry Bud Melman was holding the microphone in the wrong direction. That
right.
was explosive for college people.
He came up with that himself accidentally.
Well, no, that's what made it beautiful, but the idea of sending that man out there at the Port Authority with towels, it was the most beautiful thing. Thank you for inventing that. Oh, my God.
Well,
wow.
You're welcome. I think the most defining Letterman did early years was running things over with a steamroller, which was not my idea at all, but it was great. That's what got me excited about wanting to write for that show. But my favorite thing at Letterman that I pitched that Letterman would never do was this idea called the Big Red Wig. And it was just this idea that for an entire month you'd be billboarding coming up at the end of the month, the Big Red Wig. And then after 3 or 4 weeks of that, you would have just the day would come and the audience would be sitting there and you'd have the special theme song and 5 or 6 armed security men would come out with a display case, a locked display case, with just a big red clown wig in it. And someone in the audience would get a chance to wear it and sit for the entire show in the big red wig. And that was it. I just thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever thought of. And
I can see why you were fired from Letterman. No, I'm kidding.
And probably wisely, it got turned down over and over again. Now, the head writer loved it, too. And the head writer kept pitching it to him. Until finally one day, the head writer said, after, like, a whole pitch for other stuff, said to Dave, okay, now about the big redwood.
Wait, I'm losing you. I'm losing your voice on the telephone there.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right.
Okay. Much better. No, it's funny. Was the thing on the old Ernie Kovacs show. I don't know if you know this, but the host of this program, his father used to say that he used to watch the Ernie Kovacs show. And there was this time when Kovacs would get on the air and he said, oh, okay, you know, among next week's guests, we're going to have this group from Africa. They're coming over called the Nairobi Trio.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Week after week, you would talk them up. And then every week, you say, oh, we couldn't get visas for them. We couldn't get them into. But next week, we'll have them. And this would go on for weeks, building up this exciting musical trio from Africa. And, of course, when he brings them on, it's the guys in the monkey suits, which would probably be better than any actual trio from Africa, now that I think about it.
Then they did that song, and it was the funniest thing in the world.
Oh, it was brilliant. Yeah.
Big Ernie Kovacs fan. I actually used to spend hours at the Museum of Broadcasting watching old Ernie Kovacs because you couldn't access him any other way. But let me tell you my favorite tweet.
Yes.
I'll tell you the tweet that got me the most followers so far.
Please.
This basically shows you that at heart, I'm basically like a stand-up comedian. My tweet was during the convention, the Democratic convention, and Biden was speaking, and they kept cutting to his family. The tweet was simply, I see Joe Biden, and I see Bo Biden. Where's Banana Fan of Bo Biden?
This is funny. This is cute. You sort of had to be there, but even then you still don't. So, no, that's funny. Thank you.
I don't think you should attenuate the quality of that joke by saying you have to be there. You don't have to be there.
Okay. Banana.
Wherever you are right now, at home, at your computer, in a car, wherever you are, that's a fucking great joke because it's so stupid and simple. And I got to tell you, I mean, I've had much, much better and funnier tweets. But boy, that just like increased my following by, you know, 100 people. So it was an interesting window into the world of Twitter for me.
It sure is. Well, if you want to join at David Yazbek, also go to the Facebook page, also davidyazbek.com. Mr. Yazbek, David, if I may call you that, it has been an absolute charming delight talking, despite the F words, even those I like. You are funny, you are delightful. I wish you incredible luck with the projects that you're developing and with your band that people can see. Where can they see them on Monday?
92nd Street Y, Tribeca, in New York City, every first Monday of every month, November 5th. You can see me, you can see my band, you can see Adam Gettle, and you can see David Wayne, who directed Role Models, Wet Hot American Summer, and was in Stella and the State.
Oh, my God, I remember those programs as well. It has been a delight, absolutely, talking to David Yazbek. I want to thank you so much for being in the neighborhood and wish you nothing but future hilarity and success.